This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Good morning. It is 9 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is Independence Day. And coming up in about an hour, it'll be Air Cascadia. Actually, at 10:30. We get a combination show, apparently, at 9 o'clock, a special edition of Press Watch combined with Fight the Empire. Today, hosts Teresa Mitchell and Per Fogring will compare the American dream with the Chinese dream. And then at 10, Air Cascadia is off today, so we'll jump right into Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11, we'll hear Between the Covers with host Jennifer Kemp. Today's guest is Washington State author Scott Elliott, who has just released a new novel entitled Temple Grove. And at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk, hosted by Patricia Welch. Today, we'll feature an encore edition of our interview with legendary author Maya Angelou. In her new book, Mom and Me and Mom, Angelou shares the deepest personal story of her life, her relationship with her mother. That's all coming up, but once again, coming up next, a special edition of Press Watch combined with Fight the Empire, right after this on KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
Also, thanks to a grant from Friends of KBOO, supporting locally produced, organically grown, homemade programming for Portland and the world. Thanks, KBOO, for 45 years of music, current affairs, and live broadcast. Friends of KBOO can be reached at 503-788-2533.
It's Press Watch and...
Fight the Empire!
I'm Teresa Mitchell and I'm here with Per Fogring and we're combining our shows today. Happy holiday to you. Happy Respect the Fourth Amendment Day.
There we go. July 4th, Fourth Amendment. That's what it means.
May the Fourth be with you.
Okay, all right.
And today we are hoping to be joined by Pepe Escobar.
That would be at 9:30. He is in Hong Kong, so I hope we're able to connect with him. But he wrote a very interesting article about the Chinese dream. You know, we hear about the American dream, and he wrote about the Chinese dream.
This should be interesting. I mean, I've noticed Chinese tourists, and anytime you see tourists coming in from a nation, that means that something interesting economically is happening. And I would be more specific, a middle class is forming.
Mm-hmm.
A group of people confident and wealthy enough to want to go overseas and see what's happening. And, you know, good for them. I'm happy about that. And it also kind of reflects on how much the middle class has been downgraded in the U.S. because U.S. tourism, I should think, is on the decline.
I don't know. A lot of things are. I think just travel in general is on the decline. Global shipping is on the decline. Quite a few things are declining.
Well, the wealth of the American middle class is certainly on the decline.
Well, it's become a kind of a term you use for the... We used to call them the working class, but now we sort of promoted them to the middle class.
Yeah, that's sort of a little trap to trip on.
Kind of a lace curtain thing.
Yeah, because, I'm working class, and like most people, I've seen my wages steadily be degraded by inflation. You know, you don't hear that mm-hmm. much about inflation in the U.S., but it is very steady. And over time, your wages become less and less. And if they don't keep up with inflation or get ahead of it, then you're just getting poorer and poorer. And that's the idea, apparently.
Well, they do this little scan. I mean, you know, I've noticed prices in the grocery store keep going up. But the people who do the statistics, they have a way. Well, if, say, the price of steak is gone way up, then they say that, people will switch from steak to a hamburger, which is cheaper, or they'll switch to ground turkey, which may be cheaper yet. And so by substituting these different kinds of food, they can say that inflation, they can kind of fudge over the rise in prices, you know.
Yes, jiggering the statistics mm-hmm. to hide the fact that the quality of consumption is declining along with the wealth. Well, Mr. Escobar has written several articles, and you provided one to me about...
I want to talk about the American dream.
Yeah? Okay, well,
to me, the American dream started out by... It involved killing Indians and taking their land.
Yeah, the dream was, move in and take that land.
I mean, Columbus, he came and stumbled across the island of Hispaniola, and he found the Taino Indians there, who he thought were beautiful people. They make beautiful slaves, you know.
Yeah, he tried to take several over, mm-hmm. and most of them died before reaching Europe. But he did get people to collect gold out of the streams,
mm-hmm.
Partly by coercing them. If they did not bring Mr. Columbus gold out of the streams, he chopped their hands and noses off to dissuade them from noncompliance, thus setting the tone for American capitalism and imperialism.
Well, it also set the tone for the Belgians in Congo. Congo used to be King Leopold's private property, and he had the, they had the plantations, rubber plantations. And if people, generally men didn't bring in their quota of rubber, they'd have their hands cut off. And this was back in the 1800s, and it was discovered or publicized by an Irish diplomat named Roger Casement, who had an interesting story of his own. But anyway, Casement traveled down in the Congo, and he wrote about the atrocities there, and this caused such a storm in Europe that King Leopold was forced to give up his private property. But he didn't free the people there. What he did, he turned over his private property to the Belgian government. So it continued as a colony, and I suppose maybe the worst atrocities were kind of toned down or whatever, but it continued as a colony for quite a while, basically until 1950, when Patrice Lumumba was elected prime minister, I believe, and then he was very quickly...
assassinated.
Well, he was first, his government was undermined by secessionists from Katanga who were kind of in with the mining interests. And this is still going on today under different people, you know. But Casement went on to, he was an Irish patriot, and he later on was found, he was hanged by the British because during World War I, he tried to get a shipment of arms from Germany into Ireland to for the rebel cause there.
And he just couldn't stop going with that highest bidder business.
And the British caught him, and he was hanged. But
whoops.
Anyway, we digress. Back to
the American dream. Well, I guess my first thought when I think of the American dream is it was never sustainable in the first place. And the second thought I have about it is But darn it, I want my piece of it, just like everyone else. What is the American dream now? I mean, like, the working class has been ground down by, as I was saying, inflation, but mostly by the removal of jobs. This redepression is unique in that the jobs aren't coming back because they've been removed. So we have a generation of college graduates who have no jobs per their profession to actually perform, mm-hmm. and a gigantic load of debt to pay off no matter what, since they don't have the opportunity to cancel their debt through bankruptcy as previous generations had. And so here's this double thing. They're over-indebted. The price of college was inflated. So they come out with, I can't remember what the average amount was, $37,000 or something like that. So even if they did get a good job, which is not likely, they wouldn't be able to buy a house because they have to pay off this $37,000 plus. Mm-hmm. It's constantly compounding interest first. This is indebted servitude, and it is more of the indebted servitude because because of the rocky economic circumstances that graduates are finding themselves in, when they have periods of time in which they cannot pay the loan, it turns over to lower and lower bottom feeders who charge more and more interest and fees and fines until what started off as $37,000 becomes $100,000. And then they're really, really in debt. And mm-hmm. then, and especially if they go through a period of unemployment long enough, they can be brought into court and they can be held in contempt of court if they're too depressed, too confused, or aren't properly notified of the court proceedings. They can actually land up in jail. And that's where you get the definition of indentured slavery.
Debtor's prison.
Debtor's prison, because the way it worked before is if you took out loans and you couldn't pay them, there was this thing called Chapter 7, and you went to a judge. It wasn't just an arbitrary thing. You couldn't just blow it off, but you could go to a judge. And the judge would say, okay, well, you can't pay this, and so you won't. And so these collectors have to go away, and they just have to eat it. And
or they get a few cents on the dollar, whatever.
And then their consolation was, well, there's this wide world out there for them to make more loans on, and loss is part of something that they had calculated in the first place. And then your penalty was you're not going to get any credit for 7 years. Well, that whole paradigm is gone, and now it's essentially indentured servitude. And I think that people should understand just how vicious that is, just how much it's changed, just how unacceptable it is, and reject it. I think the student debt should be canceled.
Oh, sure. Could that be passed on to children? I mean, if you're co-signed as somebody's debt, you know, you're liable to pay it off. But can, say, if somebody with this big debt, you know, has kids and he passes on, do those kids inherit the debt too, or does it
They can't garnish your wages, but if you leave anything of value, that can be,
right,
the estate mm-hmm. can be. Mm-hmm. Can be garnished. I just think this is utterly unacceptable. In civilized countries, you're paid to go to higher education, and they take care of you. And when I say civilized countries, I'm talking about Belgium, France, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, places where they actually consider...
Cuba.
Yeah, Cuba, places where the youth are actually considered a value, as opposed to here, where the youth are considered a investment opportunity.
Well, you know, this thing about immigration, my parents came over from Norway, and they came here because, life was better. You know, my dad grew up on a farm, and he didn't care too much for farming until he bought a summer place in Vermont, and then he sort of started digging up rocks out of the soil.
What year was that?
Oh, he came over in the early 20s.
Oh, this is substantial. I mean, the statistics show substantial... social mobility during those years.
Oh, yeah.
Social mobility
mm-hmm.
is pretty much flat now. It's over with here in the United States.
But my mom came over because for some reason she could not go to nursing school in Norway. That's what she wanted to do. Now, her father was a sea captain who lost a ship around Cape Horn, was gone for 17 years before some relative tracked him down in Oakland. But anyway, I guess a sea captain was not a very high-class position in Norway, at least that one, the little boat that he had. So she, you know, came to this country because she wanted to go to nursing school, which she did, you know. And so, but I remember when I was in school, you know, we learned about, you know, the first people came from Europe. There was opportunity. Europe was all, you know, was kind of filled up with people. All the land was owned by the landlords. Soil is sort of depleted and everything. And here they have a continent where, you know, they didn't think about the Indians very much. They thought that here is all this land just for the taking, and is pretty much virgin soil. It hasn't been tilled very much or farmed very much, and so it's a bonanza. And so they it was an opportunity. If they had to stay in Europe to get land, they would have had to fight the feudal aristocracy. But they came here, and they if they fought anybody, well, I guess they had a beginning of an aristocracy in this country, but a lot of it was just fighting the Indians and taking their land. You know, it was a bonanza for them.
Until it wasn't enough of a bonanza, and then it was time to enslave the Africans. Well nevertheless, here it is, the 4th of July, and I'm here to celebrate great Americans: Daniel Ellsberg, Edward Snowden, Private Manning, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rosa Parks, Mother Jones, Medea Benjamin. Let's see, who else can I think of?
Oh, well, yes.
Malcolm X. Great Americans. Should we invite callers to talk about...
Why don't we? What does the American dream mean to you folks? I mean... we're all here. We parents or ancestors came here from somewhere. What does the American dream mean to you? So give us a call.
Maybe a little knockoff Vespa and a three-sided hovel by the stream.
503-231-8187.
503-231-8187. Got to get the magic going there. 503-231-8187. Well, I found an article about more government. I was mentioning Snowden earlier. I found an article about more government snooping. This is from alternet.org. They write, the NSA isn't the only federal agency collecting your metadata. It turns out the good old U.S. Postal Service has long been engaged in its share of low-tech domestic surveillance. As the New York Times reports today, a Buffalo, New York bookstore owner by the name of Leslie James Pickering was recently startled to discover his snail mail being monitored by the FBI with the help of the United States Postal Service. It happened by mistake, shockingly enough, for the Postal Service and his stack of mail. Pickering noticed a handwritten card directing postal workers to pay particular attention to letters and packages sent to his home, and to show them to their supervisor for copying before delivery. It also said confidential, highlighted in green. Oops. Pickering was, to say the least, taken aback. It was a bit of a shock to see it, he told the Times. Turns out 10 years ago he was an activist of sorts, a spokesman for the Earth Liberation Front, which was labeled as a radical environmental group by the FBI. While high-tech spying on the scale that Edward Snowden recently revealed is new, low-tech spying on the part of the Postal Service has been around for a while. For a long time, it was a surveillance system called Mail Covers, the Times reports, but that has been replaced by a more ambitious program, ominously called the Mail Isolation Control and Tracking Program, in which Postal Service computers photograph the exterior of every piece of paper mail that is processed in the United States, about 160 billion pieces last year. This program was created after the anthrax attacks of 2001, which killed five, count them, five people, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It was used in the recent Rice and Letter investigation. Supposedly, postal workers only record the outside of the letters and packages before delivering them. They can't open your mail without a warrant. What is causing concern is just how sweeping the reach of this program has become. So it's the snail mail equivalent. I mean, a photograph of every single piece of mail, so they know who's sending letter to you and who you send letters to. And just like the post 9/11 Patriot Act, PRISM, and the Echelon programs, it covers everybody on the basis of a very few incidents, which are used to make everyone paranoiac. You know, when you live in a nation of 300 million, when how many people died in 9/11? Was that 3,000 total?
About 3,000.
You have to kind of look. That was 12 years ago, and you have to kind of look in perspective. You know, many, many times that many have died on the roads or have died of tobacco or alcohol. Many times. But we don't seem to freak out quite as badly. I mean, we don't have the equivalent of taking off your shoes and standing in line when you want to smoke a cigarette.
Hey, that'd be something. These people standing out on the sidewalk there with no shoes on.
Automobile deaths. What's that? 40,000 a year? 200,000 maimed? Yeah, you'd think they'd... You'd think you'd have to pass through a line and be checked for all kinds of stuff before you could even step into your car. But no, that's not the way. That's not the focus of the paranoia. But we're paranoid enough to be checking everyone's mail, which I think is disgusting. I remember when I was working for the Postal Service back in 1981, it was a big deal when they shut down. I was working in Midland, Texas, and a letter went out that the secret police in the adjoining building wanted to find. They were CIA, actually. And so they shut down the mail sorting operation, and they instructed us to look for one particular piece of mail.
Really?
Yes, and so I sort of moved mail and pretended I was looking. I was disgusted by the whole thing. But now they don't have to do that. They're photographing every single piece of mail.
Was it some one particular person they were after?
Yep. Yes, they were.
Oh, my. Wow.
Well, the other thing was everyone else that I was working with was so conformist that they thought it was just terrible that I would raise any complaint whatsoever about engaging in espionage for the CIA.
Wow. I just wonder how they store, you know, they say they could store all this information. They got this big data center that they're building in Utah. And supposedly you can store all this data forever and ever. I am skeptical about that. I really am.
Skeptical in what way?
Well, that there's enough storage capacity. There's enough, you know, these big data centers. I mean, also, you know, the ones that just, I don't know, I think they have about a dozen of them here in Oregon. You know, Prineville and the Dalles, you know, that they, every little email you send, or anybody sends, all those photos people send to each other, they get stored in the cloud. That's what the cloud is. And so they use an awful lot of electricity, I think mainly to keep the facilities cool. You know, if they get too hot, it destroys the data or something, which is one reason why Oregon is such a good place for these, because our climate is not super hot, you know. And I just... you'd think that after a while they just sort of run out of electricity to keep these things powered, you know? I mean, it's plus hacker attacks. I mean, if our enemies really want to get us, they could hack into that big storage center in Utah where
all
the files are kept.
All that data and metadata doesn't just sit there. It's continually analyzed. I mean, that was part of the Echelon program, which was exposed in the late 80s and more so in the 90s, and we talked about it here on KBOO, which is why I was a little surprised that people were so surprised about the PRISM program, which is evidently just a ramping up of the Echelon program. And one of the really creepy things about Dictionary and Echelon was that it was hoovering up information from all electronic sources around the world, but also that it was processing it, it was sorting it according to that technology, you would call it keywords. They would look for certain words, and out of zillions of emails and phone calls, which would be monitored with voice recognition technology, they would select words and phrases that, the American Secret Police, the NSA, thought might be interesting to them for whatever reason. Historically, I think I can say for ideological control, even though they always maintain that they're always just looking for terrorists. But look who gets called a terrorist. You know, a person chalking an anti-mayor message on a sidewalk gets charged.
Oh, he got acquitted. Nelson Mandela was labeled a terrorist. And, you know, there's a lot of news about Nelson Mandela now because he seems to be on the brink of death. But, you know, he's a very revered figure, even in this country. But we forget that he was actually labeled a terrorist by our government, and the CIA helped the apartheid government track him down and sent him off to prison for 27 years.
Yeah, that and a thousand other indices mm-hmm. show that when they're talking about terrorism, they're talking about ideological control, which is why I call the FBI the Federal Bureau of Intimidation. They just mm-hmm. want to keep a lid on things, and they want to continually give the United States people the message, don't think too much and don't think in this manner. So the fact that PRISM, and previously Echelon and now a post office, can take all this information and construct, what they do is they construct profiles that are so sophisticated and that are applied to with such sophisticated near artificial intelligence programs that they can predict the next thing that you're going to do before even you know you're going to do it.
You know, one I read an interesting thing the other day. They said that one reason for building this big data center in Utah, it relates to the Mormon Church. You know, they have their missionary program, and they send missionaries all around the world. You know, you do your 2 years if you're a good Mormon, and the Mormon Church has apparently they have excellent language training, and so these missionaries, you know, when they do their 2 years, they're back in Utah, made a lot of them, and so apparently there are a lot of people in Utah with language skills who are available for translating any messages that the government wants to have translated.
Well, that's that sort of thing goes back many years with mm-hmm. American Secret Police. Of course, the John Birch Society is named after, you know what I'm going to say, named after someone who was busted by the Chinese government for going into China to sell Bibles when he was actually working for, I think it was the CIA. It was one of those three-letter spook organizations. But, that technique is pretty well-worn, I guess, because it works pretty well. You know, you get people talking religion, and the people they're associating with will pretty much focus on religion, and they can get away with all sorts of things. So Pepe Escobar coming up in a few minutes. Pepe Escobar. Well, perhaps you could introduce him, Karen.
Well, he's from Brazil originally. He writes for the Asia Times. That's where I read his stuff. Asia Times is a real good source of news and articles. It's online. And Pepe Escobar writes for them. And he's also on the Tom Dispatch, which is another good news and information source. And he's been writing about Asia now for quite a while. He's written books about what he calls Pipelinistan. You know, this is one way of figuring out, you know, these wars in Iraq and all the stuff in Central Asia. It's over pipelines. And apparently, for some people, the civil war in Syria has to do with pipelines. I've been following his stuff. Actually, I've interviewed him before, a very engaging guy. And so he's written this article that was in the Asia Times about called the Tao of Containing China. But it's about the Chinese dream, sort of comparing it to the American dream. And there's some similarities. So that's who Pepe Escobar is. And
I see that he gets credit for having an article entitled Get Osama Now or Else, which was published by Asia Times Online 2 weeks before the terrorist attacks of 11th of September 2001. So I guess he pretty much knows how to tap into the zeitgeist there.
Oh, really? Wow, okay. Well, he's written a lot of interesting stuff, and he's written some books. I think his most recent, if I can find it here, is he's Obama Does Globalistan. That's his latest book, and he's written about Pipelinistan, and so I hope we can get him. I don't know, it's about pretty soon our engineer will try and phone him up. He's in Hong Kong, and so hopefully we can connect.
Yeah, well, just before we get him, perhaps we can get the latest on Ed Snowden and what's happening there. Last I heard, he was still hiding out in that creepy non-area in the Moscow airport.
Great. All right.
then it must be time to talk to Pepe Escobar.
All right, Pepe Escobar, there? Hello?
Yes, I am.
Hey, welcome to KBOO once again. How's everything going?
Fine, thank you. Greetings from the South China Sea.
Is that where you are? Are you out at sea or are you in Hong Kong?
Well, I wish I was in the middle of the sea. No, I'm in Hong Kong at the moment.
Well, now you've written this very interesting article on the Tao of Containing China about the Chinese dream. So can you tell us about that?
Oh, that's, look, it's a really long story. I'll try to be very concise.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's their $6.4 trillion program for the next 7-8 years to basically urbanize as many as 250 million people. This is something unheard of in the history of humanity. And the Chinese Communist Party, they think they can pull that off.
Which is absolutely
extraordinary when you consider all the challenges involved in terms of finding jobs for these people in the big cities, how to locate these people, how to give them a residence permit, how not to inflate this already congested big cities with slums all over the place, how to recondition their mode of production, in fact, less geared towards export to the rest of the world. Of course, this will continue, but at the same time, creating and expanding their internal market.
Well, let me take a moment to introduce.
This is what we're discussing at the. Go ahead.
I just wanted to take this moment to introduce my co-host, Teresa Mitchell. We are combining our shows. She does the Press Watch show, which precedes mine. So she is on this show with me.
Hi there. And
Wonderful.
Thanks. I already had a question for you. This $6.4 trillion to urbanize, this arose from Hu Jintao's momentum?
No, this is what they discussed and approved at the latest National Party Congress in March.
Oh, this is even newer stuff.
I was there for a day or two, and I could talk to some people on the margins of it. This is a rough estimate. It could be even more. It would be more or less two consecutive five-year plans. They were thinking in terms of 2022-2023. But the numbers, of course, for us, this is something ungraspable, the scale of everything. I always try to picture those far-flung provinces in China, like, Gansu province, for instance, where they have that corridor. Where at the end of the Great Wall, to the right, and to the left is basically a Tibetan Xinjiang, those enormous, vast spaces, basically unpopulated. They launched a campaign in 1999 called Go West to basically try to colonize Tibet and Xinjiang. And we've been seeing some of the unwelcome aspects of this colonization, which is disturbances in Tibet and disturbances in Xinjiang practically every month, like we had last week, in fact. It's a colonization of Xinjiang by Han Chinese. The Uyghurs are totally dispossessed, and they are treated as second- or third-class citizens. But for China, this is essential. First of all, they need to harness a lot of unexplored oil in Xinjiang as well, and gas as well. Xinjiang, all these important pipelines coming from Siberia, coming from Turkmenistan, coming eventually from the Arabian Sea in Gwadar in Pakistan, they will all connect in Xinjiang and then from Xinjiang connect to the eastern coast. So it's essential. It's like the Chinese equivalent of what the Brazilians tried to do with the Amazon rainforest. Obviously, Brazil was impossible to colonize the Amazon rainforest. And for the Chinese, it's absolutely impossible to more or less colonize a huge desert area like Xinjiang. But they have the will and they have the numbers. It's crazy. Everywhere you go in Xinjiang, you see the hand of the centralized state. You see the hand of Beijing everywhere. So in terms of a collective drive, maybe they can pull it off. But the distortions, especially in the big cities, are going to be huge. Can you imagine a big city like Shanghai or Guangzhou with 25, 30 million people with influx from central provinces and from western provinces as well? It's going to be an absolute nightmare, and not to mention the ecological consequences, of course.
What's up with these huge empty cities that are being built? Is that part of that plan?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your question.
What's up with these huge empty cities that are being built here and there on Chinese territory? Is that part of this plan you're talking about? Urbanization?
You mean like a cluster of Singapores here and there, scattered all over the territory?
Well, there are these cities that they're new, they're brand new, beautiful cities, but there are no people living there. I've seen pictures of them.
Unoccupied.
Exactly. It's crazy. This is the wacky side of Deng Xiaoping's dream of having 1,000 Singapores. And some of these Singapores are exactly literally in the middle of nowhere, and nobody's going there. So yes, it's dysfunctional because it's basically real estate speculation scams linked to party officials. So these cities, these are unplanned, sort of planned, but in the end, unplanned cities that sprout in the middle of nowhere. So it's crazy because it depends not only with directives from Beijing, but the tug of war between Beijing and the provinces. And some provinces have more leeway than others, and some provinces are more corrupt than others. So this is linked to what they discussed a lot during the party congress in March, which is the new mantra of Xi Jinping, the fight against corruption inside the Chinese Communist Party. But this is, I don't see that happening in the short term. It's absolutely impossible. There's no way.
Seems kind of unsustainable to me. Where all these people coming into the cities, what do they do? They're supposed to.
Exactly, because look, if you are a relatively skilled worker in the middle of nowhere in Sichuan, and you go to a big city like Chongqing or Chengdu, no, the odds are good that you're going to have at least a relatively decent job, and then later you can bring your family. If they reform the residence permit, the huku system, then you can bring your family, settle down, and live not in a slum, but at least in one of those state-provided condos. But if you are a peasant in one of these provinces, if you go to the big cities, this is something that you see already all over China, the phenomenon of these itinerant workers, they call the Mingong. They go straight to a slum, they cannot get a job, they cannot get a residence permit, they sit with resentment when they see all these the new Chinese middle class spending on Pradas and Audis. And this is going to simmer, and later on we're going to have disturbances all over the place. In fact, they are already. It's not noticed. We in the West don't know about it. And even inside China, extremely restricted. You only know about them if you go to the Chinese internet in forums. And then you see people talking about the urban disturbances virtually everywhere all the time.
Well, if all these people, who is going to feed all the people in the cities? Where are they going to get their food from?
Where are they going to get their food, you mean?
Yeah, people, if everybody's living in a city, somebody has to be on the farm growing food.
I know, but and there's an extra problem that's food imports. In the case of, for instance, Australia, Brazil, Argentina, these countries are absolutely essential for China. in terms of their food input. And obviously, in the country, in China, it's very complicated because there's a lot of mountains and a lot of desert in China as well. So compared to the size of the country, the arable land is not a lot. I don't remember the exact figures now, but it's not more than 25-30% of the whole area of the country. So there is they need to import a lot of food. So they rely basically on, like I said, Australia, Brazil, and Argentina, for instance.
But that depends on cheap oil too, doesn't it?
Well, the thing is, as much as we talk about their, they have a very complex national strategy in terms of importing oil and gas from as many sources as possible. But they still rely very much on coal. I think it's still around 70% of energy in China. They still rely on these huge coal factories. Even around Beijing, we have coal factories. At the same time, they are trying to diversify as much as they can. Those pipelines that are coming from Siberia, two pipelines, the pipeline 3 years ago that they built from Turkmenistan to Xinjiang, pipelines from Myanmar. A few days ago, they were discussing the possibility of something that I had reported for a long time, in fact. One of those pipelines, the Iran-Pakistan pipeline, originally was supposed to go to India. So because a lot of pressure from the Bush administration and the first Obama administration, the Indians gave up. So China, a few days ago, they were mulling the idea of, yes, building an extension of this Iran-Pakistan pipeline to Xinjiang from the port of Gwadar in the Indian Sea. So their strategy is extremely complex. It's basically the essential part of the strategy. They want to bypass the Strait of Malacca and the Strait of Hormuz as much as they can. So this means Pakistan, this means gas from Iran, gas from Turkmenistan, gas from Siberia. They have an agreement with Venezuela. They're importing 1 million barrels of oil a day. They're going to invest heavily in the pre-salt deposits in Brazil as well. So they're buying oil and gas from everybody, not to mention Africa, of course.
That's a lot of pipelines.
This is 30% of their consumption, you know.
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to Per Fagering and Teresa Mitchell in a special Radio Zine edition, Press Watch and Fight the Power. We're here with Pepe Escobar talking about China, the middle class rising in China, about the various unique problems and opportunities in China and just what's happening there.
Well, this sort of points to me, it looks like that China and Russia, I noticed the other day they announced that they're having some kind of combined military maneuvers. And I'm just wondering, this kind of points towards China and Russia together with other nations there in Central Asia, kind of between them ruling over what they call the Asian heartland?
No, it's not as ambitious as that, in fact. They have for the past 3 or 4 years, a very close strategic partnership, the Russians and the Chinese. So they're having military drills together, all that stuff. They're also part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization with most of the Central Asian stands. Uzbekistan is the only one that is not part of it. It's people in the West tend to think that this is a sort of Asian NATO. It's not, because it's not a military alliance. They have an economic arm as well. They have been trying to organize themselves in the long run. There's a very strong fight against terrorism, especially via China and Russia. Muslim terrorism, of course, let's go straight to the point. Movements like the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, which is very closely linked with the Taliban, trying to contain the Taliban inside the Afghan territory and, prevent the Taliban from proselytizing all across Central Asia. So we have this already established for the past decade, in fact. But in terms of Russia and China together ruling the heart of Eurasia or the Eurasian heartland, no, definitely not. First of all, because the Chinese are not thinking in expansionist terms at all. The only thing that they really want and need, in fact, is a first-class navy. As they, you know, they are always saying that explicitly, in fact, to defend our national interests in the South China Sea, especially, and in the Indian Ocean, to protect our fleet of energy cargo back and forth between the Middle East and China, all that.
I saw that
and
they
Russia,
just had a...
obviously, they want to recover something that they already recovered, in fact, which is their influence all across the former Soviet republics in Central Asia. This is already a done deal for Russia. So it's not that they are thinking in terms of China and Russia together confronting NATO at the borders of the heartland. This is not going to happen. I would say this is a paranoid fantasy of some people in Washington. In fact.
Although they are holding naval drills today, China and Russia.
Yes, they do, but it's normal. Everybody does naval drills in Asia. When I was in Singapore a few weeks ago, there was a naval drill in Southeast Asia as well, with the U.S. and lots of Southeast Asian nations as well. And this is normal in Asia.
And I see also that they only have apparently one aircraft carrier, which they are practicing with.
Yes, only one. True, only one. And the next, it's going to take a while for the second one to show up. But, it's slowly. Of course, they increased a lot their investment on defense. But still, compared to the U.S., it's a fraction. It's less than 20% of what the U.S. invests. So it's still a fraction. It's negligible. It was very interesting. Like in Singapore a few weeks ago, when Chuck Hagel went to the Shangri-La Dialogue, which is an annual defense cooperation meeting in Singapore with everybody, all the 10 nations of the Association of the Southeast Asian Nations. This year, the Chinese sent an ultra-hardcore guy, a major general from the PLA. He was there. He listened to Hagel. He paid very close attention to Hagel's speech. And then basically he said, look, so what is going to be your pivoting here in Asia? Is it against us? Is it containment of China? Is it pleasing your allies? Is it both at the same time? What is going to be? And Hagel, more or less, he didn't know what to say. Really. It was very hard to spin that in front of top guys from the PLA. Because the Americans themselves, they still don't know what's the reach of the pivoting. There's a lot of speculation everywhere in Asia, here in Hong Kong, in China, in Bangkok, in Manila, in Hanoi, because nobody knows for sure what this really means. Is it just a closer collaboration between U.S. Navy and some Southeast Asian actors? Is it an overall very broad containment policy against China? Nobody can tell for sure.
Well, it seems to me the U.S. has been trying to make inroads into Central Asia for a long, long time now. After the Soviet Union fell, and people were saying, well, we defeated the Soviets. We don't need NATO anymore. But lo and behold, NATO now is all over the world, and it's trying to expand into Central Asia. Do you think the goal of the Russians and Chinese is just to keep the U.S. out of there?
The American strategy in Central Asia, if we look at it in detail, was an absolute disaster. The two Bush administrations and the first Obama administration, they got absolutely nothing out of Central Asia. Turkmenistan, instead of doing a deal to sell their gas to Europe, they made a deal with China, and China even built a pipeline for them. They lost a basis in Uzbekistan, the Kanabad base near the Afghan-Uzbek border. They lost it. They just lost the Manas base in Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstan said, no, now that's for good. We're going to cancel the contract for you to use our base.
Well, that makes me wonder about U.S. imperialism.
There's no way to spin it. NATO lost the war in Afghanistan, period. And now the U.S. is having to deal with the Taliban in an office in Doha, which is beyond absurd. This is what the Taliban were doing with Clinton in 1997, 1998. We're back to 15 years ago. It's completely crazy.
And Afghan copper is being sold wholesale to China as well.
Exactly. And in terms of exploiting the natural wealth of Afghanistan, who's ahead? Russia and China, with a few Japanese companies as well.
Well,
and Malaysian.
Well, it seems to me then that Russia and China and the nations of Central Asia are doing pretty well just among themselves, and the U.S. has been relegated to a foothold in the Middle East, and now seems to be settling on trying to get into Africa.
Exactly. And by the way, I got a lot of extreme negative feedback from Africans about this current Obama trip. Basically, they were saying it's too little, too late. He comes here, and then he tells us, look, you cannot have a car in every house and air conditioning, otherwise the planet is going to boil over. You have to remain poor. This is how it was interpreted, not only South Africa, all over, in Ghana, in Nigeria, in Northern Africa. So it was an absolute blunder. It was really too little, too late. They should have done that during the first Bush administration when the Chinese were going to Africa and striking deals with 30 different countries and then bringing them back to Beijing, you know, treating them lavishly with enormous banquets, clinching deals with everybody. And that's why China of course, they are using a lot of different countries in Asia for their own natural resource needs.
But it's a much more successful strategy.
A lot of these countries as well. And the Chinese don't have a negative view of Chinese investment in Africa at all.
Well, we seem to be, you know, in a world of more expensive resources and a world of looming climate catastrophe, it would seem to me that the American dream and the Chinese dream are really running up against obstacles.
You're absolutely right about that. We didn't even talk about the ecological imbalance, of course. If we have a Chinese dream that is going to replicate the fundamentals of the American dream in terms of lots of waste, in terms of this absolutely absurd consumption of energy, then yes, the planet is doomed. They are investing a lot of money on green energy in China, but it's still, you know, this is a fraction, and it's a long-term project as well. Something that is very worrying is that this new Chinese middle class, when you see them, especially here in Hong Kong, in fact, Hong Kongers have created an enormous animosity vis-a-vis the Chinese. They say, look, these are the nouveau rich. They come here. They destroy everything around it. They buy everything in sight. They're even taking, you know, even our jobs sooner will be gone. They don't know how to treat other people. They are arrogant, and they behave like barbarians. Can you imagine this multiplied to 300 million, 500 million all over Asia and soon all over the world with the explosion of Chinese tourism as well? Obviously, totally unsustainable. Man.
Well, where do you see it leading?
I'm sorry?
Well, where do you see it leading to?
Well, I hate crystal balls. Really, really. But like we were talking, if the Chinese dream reproduces the American dream, you know, with the especially the development of the U.S. in the 50s and the 60s, if the Chinese go the same way, it's going to be an absolute disaster. And obviously, there will be an implosion in China, because this new middle class, sooner or later, it's not going to be only Prada and a trip to Paris. They're going to want more political participation in their local, regional, and national decisions.
That's
the ultimate nightmare of the Chinese Communist Party.
That's what I wanted to ask you about.
Like, you know, this Monday in Hong Kong, we had our usual demonstration about the commemorating the handover from the Brits 16 years ago. And it's fantastic, because basically what you see is this enormous range of demands and conflicts against China that surface in a demonstration like this. They don't want here to be puppets of China. And sooner or later, we're going to have people in Shanghai or Beijing or in Guangzhou, the big city. Same thing. We don't want to be treated by the Communist Party like a bunch of kids. We want to express our own desire. So in the long run, the potential for a democratic, pro-democracy movement in China is huge. And I wonder how the Chinese Communist Party is going to contain all this.
I wanted to ask you further about that. Here in the U.S., we have, well, the world's largest corruption regime. We have offshore trillions by U.S. corporations. We have trillions in the black budget. We don't even get to know what it is. The Pentagon hides trillions of dollars. There's trillions given away to the banks, peripheral to the TARP bailout. Meanwhile, the students are impoverished. Poverty's on the rise. We had Occupy protests. How is it? I mean, it seems to me a less stable situation here in the U.S. Is it less stable in China or more stable over the last few years?
To answer you, it's a very good question. It's very hard to compare both systems. If I say that in China is more stable, it's because the repression machine is absolutely awesome. So, you know, if you have the embryo of a worker unrest in a plant somewhere, this thing is suffocated in a matter of hours. And it doesn't spread to other cities or other provinces. So the central control is something you have to see to believe, to see it to believe it. It's really, really extremely well organized. Okay, well, the Chinese Communist Party, they have 80 million members, plus networks all over the country. So they really control everything that happens in China. But at the same time, in terms of corruption, level of corruption is equivalent, is not even worse than the U.S., and certainly much worse than many other developing countries. And that's why the Chinese Communist Party is so worried. They need to have this... it's a very Chinese thing, a national consciousness campaign to start moralizing party officials, even details like, you know, instead of if you go out with your cohorts on a banquet, you're going to have only three dishes and a soup. And this is an official motto, only three dishes and a soup. And the president himself keeps speaking about this every day on television, you know. So they are really worried about corruption in a party level, locally, provincially, and nationally. But they only started this campaign. This is going to take years, you know.
Well, it seems to me that I wonder how this Chinese middle class will deal with disappointment. The American dream is disappointing a lot of people. What if the Chinese dream disappoints them? Where will they? What will they do?
Well, we're still not there yet, right? Mm-hmm. We have the new Chinese middle class. It started to spread its wings, let's put it this way, roughly, 10 years ago, 12 years ago. So it's in its infancy, you know. So, you know, now they have a condo. Now they have maybe an imported car. They made their first trip to Europe or to the U.S. They are starting to see the world. They are comparing living in China with living in developed countries in the West.
So interesting.
It's a long-term process, but it has already started. So I would say that till the end of this decade, this is going to translate into a lot of social demand and political demand. And obviously, the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, we may disagree with them ideologically, but these are very, very clever people. They already plan 5, 10, 15 years in advance. They're already trying to prepare themselves to the beginning of for 2020, 2022, when they see that, okay, we're going to have our inflated middle class by then will be, in their own projections, 300 to 400 million people.
Wow. Well, I hear the
they're
music.
We're going to have a lot of demand. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to, and we need to satisfy these demands, otherwise they're going to throw us out.
Well, I hear the music playing. I think our show is over. We've been talking with Pepe Escobar, who writes for the Asia Times and the Tom Dispatch. His most recent book is Obama Does Globalistan. Pepe Escobar, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I hope this was helpful.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah, we're understanding more all the time. Thank you very much.
Okay, let's do this again as soon as possible.
Okay.
Awesome. KBOO, Portland, KBOO 90.7. Stay tuned. Eric Cascadia is off. We'll hear Flashpoint, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein at 11. Between the Covers at 11:30, Black Book Talk. KBOO, your People's Community Radio Station.
Flashpoints, rescuing Lakota children and defending them under the Indian Child Welfare Act. Also, the Biggs Beat returns with Big Mike Biggs and an encore broadcast of a speech by Texas State.